ज्ञानविदान्तस्य ज्ञानाञ्जनशलाकया चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः. ॐ सहना भवतु, सहनौ भुनक्तु, सह वीर्यं करवावहै, तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै. ॐ शान्ति शान्ति.
I share with my children similar demanding commitments outside the home, and yet they appear unwilling to share any of the domestic chores with me. I abhor nagging, and yet I have become a victim to it. How can I create an awareness in them so that we can reach a happy compromise?
I share some outdoor activity merely means I go somewhere and they go somewhere else. And even if all the entire family goes to the same place of work, they are all doing something else. I know of whole families of business people in South Africa. They all work in the same business. But even there, they are all doing different things. Everybody cannot be manager or director. One person is the manager, the others are shop assistants. And I don't know if that can be called sharing the same responsibility. That's one. Do people share the same responsibility? Is it possible at all? We think that just because we are called joint directors or joint trustees, we share the responsibility. We do not. Why is it so is found in the question. How can I generate an awareness in them? There is an awareness in them. What do you mean you have to generate an awareness? What do you do while you teach? You are not generating an awareness, but you are directing that awareness towards something else, towards something. Right? Everybody is aware. Everything is aware, according to one school of philosophy. Everything is aware. You cannot create an awareness, and you cannot create an awareness of something because even that is there. You are aware of that, but you are not aware of that in the same way as I am aware of it. Now, is that possible? To you, for instance, keeping the table tidy is very important. To another person, it may not be. Keeping it as untidy as possible may be important to him. Don't ask why. I used to be intrigued a long time ago why sometimes young people, especially sort of lovers type of people, when they get together in a small room with other rooms around, they keep their record player full blast. Till I understood the situation, they want to talk and they don't want others to listen in. So the only way to achieve both the results is to keep some other noise blaring out of that room. So even if you wanted to, you can't hear their whisper. How do you create an awareness of silence in them? It's not possible. Sorry. You are on the wrong wavelength. Or to use a cruder expression, you are barking up the wrong tree. To me, this looks reasonable, sensible. Though it is neither a solution to the problem that we are discussing, if there is a solution at all, nor is what I am going to say very palatable. Before you even wish that the other person may see your point of view, why don't you try to see the other person's point of view? If that is, if you find that difficult, probably you will understand that it is very difficult for the other person to understand you. If you know how to change your point of view, how to bring about a radical change in your point of view, it may be possible, remotely, that you may also suggest ways and means by which anybody may be able to work out a change in one's point of view. It's only a maybe, that's not guaranteed. I have a feeling that the moment you begin to understand the other person and the fact that that person has his or her own point of view, which is non-negotiable, then there is peace in your own heart. Because you suddenly realize that both ways you are lost. If you wish to impose your opinion on the other person, you are going to lose that person. If you are going to let that person carry on with what that person wants to do, you are lost. Heads you win, tails I lose. On the other hand, I am very suspicious of any brain-polluting approach. Not brainwashing, brain polluting. Brainwashing is clean, eh? Anything that is washed is clean. I don't know why you use the word brainwashing. Who are we to tell others what they should do, what they should not do? Children. What is children? To my mother, who is about 80, I'm still a child. I could be a grandfather now, or probably great-grandfather. What is children? What do we mean by children? I had, and perhaps even now have, very great regard for this old man. He was a retired judge. And he was the ardent devotee of a great yogi in Rishikesh, way back in the 1920s or earlier, before he was born. And he used to practice this, some kind of Kundalini yoga. And as a figure here, we have a fantastic figure, lean, thin, upright, very charming, with not a trace of ill health about anything in that body. He walked very briskly, he had enjoyed life in every way, and he was about in the late 70s, I should say, when we came to know each other. I was only in my 20s, but he often used to remark and make fun of us. "How is it, you youngsters? You are so tired and you are so weak and you can't bear the heat. You can't bear the cold. Look at me, 77. I'm all right. Such a man." And whenever I went to see him, which was quite often, at least once a fortnight I used to go and see him, at a lovely cottage, not far from the ashram. And he would entertain me very nicely with some of his own spiritual experiences and so on. And then say, you know, I could also have taken sannyas and become a swami. But my children are dependent upon me. Children are dependent upon me. This old man, children, what does he mean? I thought maybe, I knew he became a widower quite early in life. I thought maybe he got married again. I don't know that. Who knows? Maybe at 77 he may have a child of 10, 15, possible. And this went on for about 2 years, when one day, when I visited him, he announced, one of my children will be coming in a few days' time. Right? Let's have a look. Probably a teenager. And then a few days later, I walked out of my room, which was right on the Ganges bank, and looked at the little ferry disgorging its load of passengers, and out walked the retired judge, looking very young, younger than ever, along with his elder brother, who was walking with difficulty, with the help of a walking stick, stoop-shouldered. And both of them walked towards me, and the retired judge introduced me, this is my son. There was a difference of just 17 years between them. And as ill luck may have it, the 17-year younger son looked 25 years older than the father. And as one would expect, he died before the father, long before the father died. Children, what children? What do we mean by children? And then, I don't know who wrote out this question. Before we feel disappointed with our own children, is it possible for us to reflect for one moment whether our own parents could have voiced exactly the same sentiments, same complaints? What about your mother? If I went to ask her, what do you think of your daughter? What would she tell me? Slightly worse. So this whole business of trying to influence one another has to be given up sooner or later. Even if you and I feel that we have found the key to happiness, to health, and to this and that, if you have a wonderful idea concerning health, happiness, morality, godliness, yoga, how is it that the other person is not able to see it as you see it? The other person is an adult. You can do all these when the child is really a child. The Bible gives you 7 years. And somehow or other, that tallies exactly with the Hindu tradition. On the 8th birthday, the child is invested with the sacred thread and handed over to the teacher. knowing that the parents cannot do anything with that child from then on. Why is it that that person is unable to see the truth as you see it? Incidentally, I have a sliding scale approach to this problem. Whether it is a father and son or a guru and disciple, you may be able to transmit some sort of ideas, not communicate, transmit some sort of ideas up to one point. And what is that point? The point at which your son or your disciple turns around and says, well, I don't think I would do that. I would do it my way. It's different. Why do you want me to do it the way you want me to do it? Let me do it the way I want to do it. Then, says the Oriental or Indian tradition, treat that person as your brother from there on. He or she is not a child anymore. And that's it. When the child or the disciple turns around and says, why should I do that? That's the end. And if you don't put a full stop to that disciplining tactic, you're going to ask for trouble. It's not possible. And that is why I believe, I've not come across this, I don't know where it is. I believe it is in the Bible, it is said, give me the first 7 years of a child and I'll give you the man. If you have not been able to do this within those 7 years, you cannot do it later. What is the difficulty in doing this within those 7 years? The difficulty is yours. Because during those 7 years, the child does not really reason. The intellect is not very highly developed. The child lives almost entirely on an observation dimension. It's not quite imitation. The child is constantly observing the parents and the elders. It doesn't reason. There is no intellect. If the father and mother are fighting and quarreling, the child does not enter into a sort of judgment about it and listen to the two points of view or two sides of the argument. The child is hit directly by it. Father, mother, quarrel. That's it. That's all I want. I'm not interested in anything else. So that impression has been formed during those 7 years. And that makes it extremely difficult for the adults to train children. I'm not saying example. It's a lot more than example. It is the impression that that child gains from the environment. Not only you. Not only you, even the others. So, is it possible to create the ideal environment in which the child might grow up, and thus be impressed by healthy impressions? It's a far cry. You struggle hard, and then the child goes to school and plays with the neighbors and picks up some funny things there. The same thing, because you are not the only formative influence in the life of the child. The child from age 1 to 7. Where the reason does not function, independent of the rest of the child. The child is a yogi. From 1 to 7, the child is a yogi. Totally integrated being. The split begins later. The split between thinking and emotion and living and all these, this begins later. From 1 to 7, the child is a total yogi. I remember a rather pathetic instance in Israel where a fanatic vegetarian who was married and the husband and three children, I think, had tragedy after tragedy because of the fanaticism. The child was brought up on absolutely strict vegetarian diet, which meant not even cereals. Cereals are not vegetables. Seeds. You can't call them vegetables. No milk, no yogurt, they are not vegetables. Sorry, they are animal products. That you get them out, get it out of the animals benign, in a benign way, is not an excuse to call milk vegetarian. And she was such an idealist in that respect that she had to get it from her own garden, otherwise she was not quite sure whether it was organically grown and this, etc. Right. To her it was all right. Just one little digression here. To her it was all right. Mahatma Gandhi had a disciple called Acharya Kripalani. He fell in love with another of Mahatma Gandhi's disciples, Sucheta Kripalani. Both of them were living in a sort of ashram setup. They wanted to get married. But Mahatma Gandhi said, no, both of you must remain celibates. These two were very young. And I don't know whether it was said by one of these couple or by somebody else. It was remarked, I would put it that way. Mahatma Gandhi was married and he had his first son when he was 13. And he had a full married life. He had four sons eventually. Okay, he has had all that and now he has become a celibate when he was 35, 40 years. Okay. Now, we are youngsters, we have never had, we don't know what married life means, we don't know what it is to have a wife and children and all that. How can you convince these people that you should not marry and you should dedicate your lives as celibates? Doesn't make sense. It was all right for him because he has had it. It may not be all right for these people because they have not had it at all. They have not had the experience at all. I think you heard, some of you heard the Bhagavatam reading a few days ago. That if you cannot preach renunciation to someone who has not experienced the world at all, that silly thing hangs at the back of your mind, oh, I wish I had, maybe it would have been very nice to get married, maybe it would have been very nice to have a couple of kids and then renounce. So, this vegetarian was more or less imposing it upon her wife and children. The elder son, I think, accepted it as far as it would go. And when he didn't like it, he went and did something else. He could reason. But the youngest one was a tragedy. It's too small. And therefore he saw his father and his mother and they were all vegetarian, so he grasped it. But when he went to school, the other boys were having chocolates and ice cream and hamburgers. Now what do you do? Please remember that they are also influencing him. What I am saying, as I told you, may be a counsel of despair, but may be truth. It's just a whole system. It's not just one small fragment called the home situation. The child goes outside the home, he is bombarded with all these other ideas. How do you influence a child in that context? Only God can do this. She stuck to her guns and did all sorts of things, and eventually the boy went to the army and committed suicide there, shot himself. So, especially in the sort of society in which we are living, one has to be extremely careful in trying to manipulate other people's minds and ideas. It's not possible. And if you are too strict in that respect, you will lose the whole person. Any sort of thou shalt not will be counterproductive. You can fix your own laws, your own rules. There is a no smoking sign there. No smoking only means no smoking here, inside here. If you want to smoke, get out and smoke. I have 10 cigarettes. You can do only that. You can fix some sort of guidelines saying, if you want this from me, you must give that. Unfortunately, that's the that is what is coming to. That is what the world, the society is coming to. Which means coercion. Is there a way out of it? It's a very peculiar approach. Not many have tried this, I guess, because of the tremendous need for self-discipline. In order to generate that awareness in the other person, you have to generate in yourself a superior awareness, an awareness that transcends all this relationship, that is able to see the truth concerning the human mind and intellect and emotion. Appreciate the other person's point of view first. Then drop a hint. This is what I learned from Swami Shivananda, and it is a very painful process. Painful to you, not to the other person. If he saw some of us doing something which he didn't approve of, he did not come down like thunder with fire and brimstone. But it's beautiful. I'll tell you that. I'll give you one example. From that, it's possible that you get some insight of the problem involved in this. If you go to him and complain to him against his Swami that he is rude and he abuses and abusive and his behavior is totally un-Swami-like, a disgrace to the whole order, he would have listened to you patiently, intently, with great attention, and possibly joined in chimbling, leaving you with the impression that, I've got it now. And then you come round you expect Swami Sivananda to call this other Swami up and whip him up. Instead, you see, minutes later, somebody bringing a basket of fruits to the other Swami. Swami Sivananda gave this as prasad. An hour later, somebody brings a cup of curd or something else. Swami Sivananda gave you this. A little later, he brings some special curry or whatever it is, prepared, sweet, prepared for Swami Sivananda. Hey, Swami Sivananda gave you this. And you stand back with your jaw dropping to the floor. My God, I thought he would chastise this chap. On the other hand, I have unwittingly helped a closer relationship between them. And now this man is going to feel that Swami Sivananda, he has gained Swami Sivananda's approval, and therefore he is going to be even more rude. Possibly that might also happen. Risky. Then, by this sort of behavior, he wins the heart of the disciple against whom you complained. Draws him closer and closer and closer. And then one day he might take him aside and say, "Oh, you're a genius. Yesterday you had you delivered a talk. Oh, fantastic. The fellow didn't even open his mouth properly. Okay, fantastic. No, there's no one like you in the three worlds. You are supreme. Only when you talk to some people, be a little careful." After 3 days of the shower of milk and honey and fruits and what have you, comes one small hint. Oh, when you talk to me, be just a little gentle. That's all. Uda, but you know, there's nobody like you. None of my disciples can equal you. You are fantastic. Well, how is your health? Would you like some more almonds? Can I send you some special fruits for you? That little hint is sandwiched between lots and lots and lots and lots of love. And this could go on for a long time. Seed by little by little by little by little. But that means before you can bring about a slight change in the other person, you have to undergo all this trauma. That is, we don't want to change ourselves and we want to change the world. It's a very simple and at least what we think an easy way out. It doesn't work. It will not work. It can only create more conflict. And maybe this is one of the reasons why children, what are children? Teenagers want to slip away and go away from anyone who exercises an authority over themselves. Swami Sivananda often used to point out how difficult it is to go without a cup of tea one morning and how easy it is to talk to others. You must give up all your attachment, you must, okay, chum. All this talk is after a good lunch. And a cup of coffee, and then you can sit and talk. But this is different. Life is very different. It's very easy to moralize. But what is the problem? It's easier to advise 1,000 than to be one of the 1,000 to follow the advice. It is said, we were talking about renunciation the other day. It is said that there is a great emperor, Janaka, who was also totally enlightened, and he was a living sage. It is also possible that the word Videha referred to the territory where he, over which he ruled. And it is also possible that it was meant as a personal attribute to him. Videha means one who had no body consciousness. Videha Mukta. They say he didn't even have body consciousness. He just was there. He was living in the body as we are living in this hall. Totally unattached, unconcerned with it. However, for all outward appearances, he was an emperor, sitting on a golden throne, etc., etc. And there is a mendicant, an ascetic Swami, who heard about this Janaka's spiritual reputation and was disgusted. This man, he is a sage? Who are you bluffing? And the other person said, no, he is a sage. A very great sage. And the ascetic said, I'll disprove you, prove you wrong. So one day he walked into the court of King Janaka. He had a staff in his hand and a water pot like the one I have come under him. And as he entered the court, he wanted to use both the hands, at least one, he knew, to exhort and to admonish the emperor. So he kept the water pot in a corner and walked towards the emperor and said, what are you doing here? Get out, if you are an enlightened man. Renounce all this. Don't pretend that you have mentally renounced all this and sit and enjoy your imperial pleasures. Come on, out. He said, yes, sir. Janaka got up, tore off his robe, threw them either, one on either side, and shall I follow you? Then he said, yes, become my disciple, I will teach you what enlightenment means. And he was terribly excited, this holy man. Both of them walked out. And the holy man had already started teaching his imperial disciple what it is to renounce and what it is to be free, totally dedicated to God and totally dependent upon God. Just as he was about to pass the final gate to the palace, he said, wait a moment, I brought a kamandalu, a water pot, a wooden water pot costing about $2, $3. And Janaka said, yes, I also saw it in your hand as you walked in. Where is it? Must have left it in your palace. I hope it's safe. Safe, I hope nobody picked up, threw it away. Come, let's go. Let's go and get it. And Janaka obliged him. They returned and the palace guard said, yes, we were about to throw it away into the trash can. Sir, lucky you came in good time. Janaka looked at that man and said, you can't give up a water pot and you think it is necessary for me to give up a kingdom? What is renunciation? You are going to teach me renunciation? You who can't give up a water pot. You are going to teach me how to renounce the empire and how to renounce the throne? That's the point. I've read a very beautiful piece of writing by Ramana Maharshi, where he says, whatever is will happen, nobody is going to stop it. And therefore he says, the wise man finds only one thing he could do, that's to keep quiet. Swami Shivananda's method was to win the other person by love, and it's possible you may be able to bring about a change in the other person. And it is also possible, this is where the danger is, this is also possible that when you love that other person, you might decide then to leave him alone.